We're about to enter into our question and answer period. I want to remind folks that please come to this microphone up here if you have a question to ask, and please provide your name and limit yourself to one question in respect for others who may want to ask questions. So I'll have Myron come back up to the microphone, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Hi, Myron. I'm Susan Giffen, and sorry, Cheryl, I'm breaking the rules right off the start. I have two questions. Myron, one is a personal question, and the other is just for some general information. My first question is to you personally, and to ask why you would look into going into federal politics. Are we not on? Why would you look into going into federal politics when there's so much need for someone like you on the reserve? And it seems to me that you're filling that need, but why would you spread yourself so thin like that? And my second question is about urban reserves. I don't understand them, and I wonder if you have an opinion on them. And just a comment, you continue to impress. Thank you.
The first question is mostly I would like to become a member of parliament because it's just my dream and my ambition. I do see myself running for council, but in a more organized and in a more respectful fashion. In regards to the urban reserves, I believe that that's a land claims issue and reserve land that was taken away. Or otherwise stolen from the Blood Reserve, and is that good? Yeah. Okay. And my personal opinion is we should be working at home first before we start branching out. If we start branching out first and not working within our own communities trying to fix them, we're going to see a lot more problems developing.
Yeah. Okay. Hello, Myron. Good afternoon. My name is Stan Knowlton. I'm also a student at the University of Lethbridge. And my question is that what are our responsibilities, you know, when we look at this idea of an urban reserve? And, you know, in addition to that, you know, as of Tuesday, with the court case R versus Day Chief, you know, what is our responsibilities of looking at it the other way? Of what is our responsibilities with the municipality inside of a reserve? And if we, you know, if we can't understand what the urban reserve is, then you know, the other way to look at it is what would municipality be inside of a reserve? You know, so those are two ways of looking at it. There's a couple sentences here that I want to read. And this is from a letter from McLeod, dated to his wife, who are both signatories to the treaty, February 10th, 1884. And it starts out to his wife here. It says, "I think I told you about the difficulty there was about the Indian treaties Mr. D and I made last year. It never occurred to me that they should be made differently in the first treaties, and surely the Indian Commission's agent should have known that some other ceremony should have been gone through with. Well, they left everything to me. I drew the treaties, and I had them all completed, and they were sent down to Ottawa and approved of. But they pointed out that D and I had to swear that they were made with the consent of the male members of each band of 21 years old and upwards. D wrote to me to make the affidavit stating that he would make his before Colonel Richards. I replied that I would do nothing of the kind, as we had dealt with only the chiefs, as the treaty showed. He wrote to me again and told He wrote me again, as I told you last month, saying that he was coming up and that he would see about the matter and take the necessary affidavits before me. I replied that if he took the affidavits, I was satisfied, but I would certainly not. So that's a letter to, from the commissioner to Dutney. Well, as it turned out, those affidavits were signed. And what it says is that every mail, all the stuff that McLeod wasn't talking about are here. So what we have are legal affidavits signed by McLeod, Dutney, on the orders of the Prime Minister of Canada, Sir John A. Macdonald. So what we have here is conspiracy, we have fraud, and we also have perjury, right in the treaties themselves. So with the case that was submitted, we're looking at on Tuesday, we're looking at this whole idea of the, under Section 42 of the Indian Act of 1876, which states, in all case wherein patents for Indian lands have issued through fraud, such patents shall be void to all intent. So any subsequent transactions or interpretations of white rights are retained or relinquished are clearly made redundant, by the fraud.
Can you ask a question?
Okay, so what is our responsibilities now that we have, with this document, that we've been able to turn the tables?
First of all, I think any type of document, and I certainly commend you for turning up these documents. treaties are part of the Constitution, as I've learned in school. And also what I also have learned is that the treaty documents were actually written and signed and then sent off. They weren't negotiated. They were pre-done for First Nations people, especially for the Blackfoot. I would see these more as a tool in our continuous battle for acceptance within Canada. Assimilation is still underway. The reserves will never be abolished. I will fight to keep my land, and it's the only land we have. And it's like my grandpa always says, if a Japanese man came to Canada, lost all his culture, he could go back to Japan. If I was in the same situation, where would I go? I'm used to answering questions. During the election, I was wasn't asked too many. Most of them went to Ted. So,
hi, my name is Susan Lingle, and I really enjoyed your presentation. You can't. Okay. Okay, my name is Susan Lingle, and I enjoyed your presentation very much. Since I've lived in southern Alberta, I've just been kind of struck by, it reminds me quite a bit of an apartheid situation. You have sort of white culture, you've Hutterites living in areas, you have First Nations and a couple other cultures with very little mixture, active mixing between them. And most things we hear about are more, I appreciate the point of, you need good role models and doing things yourselves. At the same time, I hate for the non-First Nations people to just kind of passively watch from the outside. Like, how do we break down those kind of barriers to have a little more interchange?
I spoke about that during my presentation, and like I said, a lot of Canadians have many myths about First Nations, which are, in many cases, fictional. Like I said, we don't get a free ride, this money part. I think that in order for us to come together, we need to be on a nation-to-nation dialogue. What I would like to see is for the Kainai Nation and other reserves in Canada to become nations within Canada. We need to be equal partners. The non-natives need to understand where the natives are coming from. The natives need to understand where the non-natives are coming from. And some common ground needs to be established from there. It's essentially putting yourself, and this is what I learned at the United Nations, is putting yourself in the other person's shoes to understand them better and then to get into dialogue. What we're seeing right now is we're getting just First Nations people to just come in during meetings to pray and sit on the sidelines. We need to get First Nations people at the decision-making tables of the nation immediately.
Hi, Brian. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was very good. At least somebody's running for politics. I hope you can beat some of those guys that can't talk English and all that, French properly. Well, I guess this Mike is crazy, I guess. But anyway, I wanted to ask a couple questions, and I noticed on the blood reserve that they're getting themselves involved in a lot of investment in like oil rigs and stuff like that, that they're moving to expand themselves to where they have income coming in, and from the oil industry there's big income. And the one statement that in this article that the Herald put out, like you were talking about an urban reserve, and it stated in there that it would be for Aboriginal and it would be for non-Aboriginal businesses. But what I wanted to ask you is, if that's the case for that part of the new urban reserve, why can't there be non-Aboriginal businesses now on the reserves?
As it exists today, there are. There are non-natives farming the land. There are non-natives operating businesses on the blood reserve. So in all practice, it does exist. And what we need to see more is more First Nations people doing more on the land themselves. We see more non-natives doing more on the land than we do see natives.
Yeah, but most of that land, farmland, is rented out, isn't it, to all, non
I wouldn't know how that particular section works. I mostly deal with the politics and governance, but I would imagine that there was some arrangement in place.
They speak of, when Tana Spitz was here, she spoke of a new model for reserves and a new system, like people could have ownership of their houses and look after them themselves and all that, because I can remember when they built the first houses in Brockett along the highway there. And they were nice houses, you know, and all that. But I don't know, it seems that the people don't have respect for those houses, that they let them, you see on TV, they have holes punched in the walls and all that. Do you think if you had your own ownership of those houses, that there would be more, and you paid for them yourselves, and you received the money, instead of the money going to the band, that you received the money, and then you could pay the rent or mortgages on your house? Do you think that would be a better deal?
Well, we're looking at two questions here. It's twofold. Is First Nations people, I mean, you look at individuals themselves, how are you going to make people pay for something when they don't have money themselves? So we need to solve that problem of getting people jobs. The second part with the houses is people are suffering. I just told you that I suffer from 5 diseases. And people on the reserves are self-medicating themselves with drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. It's not that we have a lack of respect for our homes. It's just that we're struggling to come to terms with the fact that we're not only suffering, but that we're trying to be heard and we're trying to be providing. There's no, again, it goes back to that same old fact. What I would like to see, again, is a nation-to-nation dialogue. And within that process, of course, you know, the Canadian Housing Mortgage Corporation would come into place. But my grandma, for instance, bought a house when she was older, my native grandma, and paid on it, and it burned down, unfortunately. But the practice does exist. The lack of respect that you talk of is mostly a result of struggling people coming to terms with their own reality. I mean, you look at me, if I were drinking and with my handicaps, I wouldn't be a very calm person.
Where did they get the money from to buy the alcohol and the drugs?
Well, we look at that's again, that's the invincible hand of oppression, is they'll get it some way, somehow. And that's why we're seeing people drinking things like hairspray and things, anything.
Yeah,
and
it
comes at a low, it comes at a very low price. And some way, somehow, you know, when you're when you have an addiction, you will do whatever you can to get it. And the money that is supplying that, it comes from various means. I mean, they're pawning stuff off, or you know, it's just the reality on the reserve. And in most cases, you know, they're drinking poison and sniffing poison.
Yeah. Do you believe in the government of Canada? Do you believe in the government of Canada and the laws of Canada?
I believe in the government of Canada, and I'm a proud Canadian. I just wish that the government of Canada would be more respectful to First Nations people as they are today.
Trevor Page. Myron, thanks very much for your presentation. I'd like you to look 50 to 100 years from now, and after you fix things up, and you do have First Nations and the federal government negotiating as equal partners, do you foresee a separateness between First Nations and non-First Nations in Canada? Where do you see Canada and the role of First Nations 50 to 100 years from now? And if there is a separateness that you see, do you think that would have any sort of reaction on Aboriginals in the United States? I mean, what do you see happening 50 to 100 years from now?
I hope I live to see 100 years from now. I'm 23 right now. Be 123 at that time. What I would see is, again, a nation within a nation concept. And the way I envision it is a municipality. The separateness would not exist. It would be a quasi-municipality in the form of a nation within Canada. Now, I know that this idea is popping into your mind that 2,000 nations in Canada is an impossible thing to think about, but think about all the municipalities in Canada that we currently have. We need to develop some sort of standard, some sort of dialogue, some codes, and I believe that the nation-to-nation idea is a good idea. And for your information, I'm going to be publishing a paper called Kainai Nation, a nation within Canada, in about 2 weeks. And I guess you could visit my homepage, people.uleth.ca, mj.wolfchild, and you could read.
Effect on the United States.
Oh, right. And if the effect on the United States is, of course, we're two separate countries, and I believe that in the United States they have a separate form. Two very separate countries, two separate forms of policy. There is a great deal of segregation and distance from the rest of the community, but I'm hoping that perhaps maybe the United States would learn from Canada's example once we have something in place. Now that we have George Bush and Stephen Harper, hopefully they'll be the Brian Mulroney and Ronald Reagan. No, seeing Irish eyes are smiling on Parliament Hill.
Sheldon Deitchy from the Blood Tribe. First of all, Myron, well done. And I do commend you for everything that you're doing. Just a comment on a couple of the questions that were made here. First of all, the comment on why isn't there non-native businesses operating on the reserve? Well, there is. Just go down and stand off the trading post. And the BB Mart are run from people that are East Indian, and other businesses such as the oil rigs are running and operating off the reserve. as well as the oil money that's in question. We're seeing a boom in Alberta and through the world economy. None of that money goes back to the First Nations people. The other thing that or never gets to the grassroots people, and it stays on the top level. And as far as the payment of houses, people do pay for their own houses, regardless of what means. People do have lands, as Myron mentioned, to the allotment. They are, payments are derived from those income that are made off the land, as well as through people like me that work, but unfortunately I don't have a house on the reserve, but people like me that do have houses on the reserve actually do pay for their houses. So it doesn't really matter. But my question is to Myron is this. Based on Stan Knowlton's remarks as far as the treaty negotiations are concerned, and he has pointed out a few questionnaire activities that has happened, how do you see that we as First Nations people can coexist with the government of Canada and people per se in Canada when these kind of documents are surfacing and we're finding fraudulent information and the whole question of the Constitution of Alberta and Canada that give legal authority on our lands? How do you see us as coexisting to accept those documents and rather than creating separatism, but rather than working as a unit to solve these problems?
Right. You know, those type of documents essentially are and could become quite, frankly, conflict starters. The spark and a burning flame that can continue. What we need to do is address these types of issues, address them at the core, understand them, and make, of course, have redress. They're talking about the head tax on the Chinese and an apology. You know, we're still waiting for an apology after so many years, so we need to start looking at these documents. The government of Canada needs to understand that their past activities have been illegal, and at the same time, I would also have to comment, you know, we have a blood tribe police service that is in essence is a human rights violator, and your tax dollars are paying for that. So, I mean, we got to look at this from two sides and start working together as one. I wish I had all the answers to all these questions, but we need to be equals. We need to be free.
Ray Harris,
you're not going to... I'm not going to fight
you. We appreciate you coming under such duress. If I had the decision to make about one of my close friends or relatives, I don't think I could do it as well as you do. So you've had us eating out of your hand. Please accept that as thanks. Okay, I'm going to give you omnipotent powers. What would you do for your people in education, K-12, if indeed you have K-12, you've got the blanket, what would you do?
I believe education is the most important tool that any person can have. And I mean, already we're looking at dropout rates at the grades of 4. I know of an individual who has a person in grade 3 who doesn't go to school. We need to instill the importance of education and the importance of it, the things that education can give you into the young minds, and plant that seed. And that blanket essentially to cover them up and tell them that there will be benefits in the future. I think what a lot of people are looking at now is they want to see tangible or real things in their grasps. Patience and a hope for the future is what we need. Money and stuff like that comes when you got an education and a job.
Myron, my name is Sylvia Campbell. Is the mic on? My question to you is, supposing you're a young Native person or maybe a two people trying to start a business, what are the barriers to you doing that? I give you an example from about 20 years ago when I taught out at Brockett. I had two of the older women in my class wanted to set up a coin laundry, and trying to get that through Indian Affairs was almost impossible.
Yeah.
Is it still that way now?
Yeah, I mean, the process to start a business on the reserve is like starting, building a great monument. There are, of course, the situations within administration, Indian Affairs, but like I said, there is no concrete, tangible foundation upon which such a business can exist. The business can be created, it can exist, but I'll guarantee you it'll fold in years. And we need to build an economy that exists, that's tangible, that works, wheels are in motion. If those don't exist, then any businesses that are attempted will ultimately fail.
And is it because they can't get a loan? They can't get the money to?
No, it's, I mean, the money's there. It's just that, I mean, the people that to which the business would operate towards, these people have no money. And if these people have no money, then they're going to do laundry in the river rather than go pay for it.
Or in Fort McLeod or Raymond or someplace.
Somewhere where it's free, wherever they can get it.
Terry Shillington, thank you for your presentation and your passion about it all. I have a question or suggestion around strategy, and I wonder if you have seriously pursued the idea of asking for an apology, a formal apology from Canadian people and the Canadian government. And I say that because I come out of a church that has issued an apology around the residential schools, and I'm aware, looking back, how growthful that is and what an educational process that is, even as our church has argued about whether or not we should. And I have a friend who's native near Standoff, not on the reserve, who tells me a whole lot of history of our relationship with Native people that I don't learn about in any white culture. And so I think there's a whole educational process that I wonder if any of your people feel the apology process is something that should be pursued, and I think it might be growthful for the white culture to have to confront some of the horrors that have been committed that we're not even informed about.
Right. You know, I'm going to bring that down to a personal level, if you will. I grew up and I was abused and neglected as a child. And when my mom apologized, it felt like it lifted so much off of my soul that she accepted responsibility. And she said, "Myron, I'm sorry." And my dad said, "Myron, I'm sorry." I was able to heal from that. First Nations people not only deserve an apology, they want it, and they will fight for it. We're seeing that in Ontario with the protests. You know, I remain hopeful that one day Canada will become the greatest country in the world, but we're not going to be until we solve the problems of First Nations people. I mean, I'm a pretty humble guy. Before my grandma got me a bed, I was sleeping with just a blanket and a pillow on the floor. And yet I go to school and do all this stuff. So you must imagine what more people are going through. And if an apology is essentially that message or that growth upon which healing can begin, then we should do it. Because healing is a lot better than just putting a Band-Aid over something and shoving it under the carpet for decades. It just gets bigger. The problems get harder.
Last question.
Myron, I've said this before in front of these kind of audiences. I went to the United States in 1932, when the blacks were way down in the social and economic scale, and during my lifetime, they have risen into the middle class and partly above, and one of the key reasons is there were quite a lot of whites fighting for them. I come back to Canada and find the native situation, both in Canada and the United States, almost where it was in the 1920s when I was growing up. I don't find significant people like these, organizations who are ready even to die, as some white Americans did on the marches to Selma and so on. Will you tell us where you find the greatest committed, organized effort on your behalf, which is also on our behalf, among the so-called whites?
I think a lot of those are, again, from people like you and compassionate Canadians who understand where we're coming from. Canadians who do not hold these myths that we are lazy, and like in that letter I received, drunken Indians getting free stuff with a free card. Compassionate Canadians who care about others, who believe that in order for us to move forward, we must move forward together, leaving no one behind. Churches, social organizations, and I hope one day that I can include the government of Canada. But we'll see. I just hope that one day we can put the government of Canada on that list.
Bob Anderson has requested one question, so that will be it.
Bob Anderson, Myron. A personal question that may be possible for you to respond. How do you sense yourself on your reserve among your own people, particularly ones maybe in your age group? What's your sense of how they react to you? You're showing hope and you're making progress, and you're this guy from the reserve that's gone to university and big time politician. How do you sense that's being responded to by others like yourself on the reserve?
It's both bad and good. I mean, I've been called many, many names in Blackfoot and English. Maybe French, I don't know. A lot of the people think of me as being a sellout, an Indian who thinks like a white. I was yelled to by an elder over the phone for about 15 minutes after she asked me what boat I came off of. I told her I haven't really been on a boat and get seasick and was born on Canada. People think I get a free ride. I mean, I have a laptop at home, a cell phone, but I pay these things monthly with, you know, I work and I go to school, and people think I got a silver spoon in my mouth, but they don't realize that some days I go without food. Some days, you know, I'm hitchhiking to Lethbridge to go to classes. But I know that there are others who are proud and want to do the same. And if anything, I want to be a messenger and a symbol of hope. And I want hope to spread across my reserve like the wind does in Anishinaabe.
Thank you, Myron, for a very thoughtful, soulful, and eloquent presentation and response to our questions. Good luck to you. I'd just like to remind you that our presentation next week is a new Arts and Cultural Center for Lethbridge. Is it a priority? So hopefully we'll see you next week. Thank you.